I spent last night in the arms of a girl from Louisiana. It's time for the SAFTAcast, and I'm your host, Scott C. Folks, we have a special episode of the SAFTAcast for you today, and I will get to that in just a moment. First, let me update you on some goings-on at the Sundress Academy for the Arts. This Saturday, March 28th, from 1 to 3 p.m. at Firefly Farms, the home of the Sundress Academy for the Arts, just outside of Knoxville, Tennessee, it is the third in a series of three workshops for the SAFTA Outspoken Project. Now, I've mentioned this on the program before, and I want to talk about it again here. For those unfamiliar tuning in perhaps for the first time or have not heard me before talk about this, Outspoken is the Sundress Academy's effort to make LGBTQ voices of Knoxville and beyond the whole South get their voices heard through their arts, be it writing, visual art, theater, whatever it may be, for a special performance in early summer. I believe it's in June this year. Coming out. This is the second year they've done it, and it has been amazing, some of the work that has been done. The third writing workshop, as I said, comes out this Saturday. If you are unable to be a part of it in presence, you can still be a part of the Outspoken movement. You can still be involved in this important project. Go to sundresspublications.com/outspoken, that's one word, O-U-T, spoken, to find out how you can support this important project and be involved in it. Now, today's episode is episode 26. We turn our attention to the podcast now. Let's do some math. There are 52 weeks in a year. We do our show every other week. Therefore, episode 26 means if you are listening to it today on March 25th, 2015, 1 year ago today at almost the exact same time, 11 a.m. Eastern, we premiered our first episode with Ken Robidoux. So today is our birthday. That is the third saddest party horn I have ever heard in my life. To celebrate, we are giving you a gift. Indeed, the gift of savings. Visit sundresspublications.com and click on store, and for a limited time, whatever you purchase and put into your cart, enter the promo code SCBIRTHDAY. That is SC for SAFTAcast, birthday, one word, into your promo code there to receive 15% off of your order. That info again, visit sundresspublications.com, click on the store, whatever you put into your cart, be it some of our upcoming titles, be it some of our past titles, whatever it is, you throw it in there and you enter the promo code SCBIRTHDAY, you will receive 15% off of your order. But note, this is for a limited time only. And if you feel like giving us a gift, and we would really love this as a gift, give us a review on iTunes. Tell people how you love the program. Put it on iTunes. Tell a stranger, tell a friend, tell somebody on Facebook, tell somebody on Twitter, tell people about us. Review us. Give us some thoughts. We do depend upon your reviews and much more to keep this podcast sustained, and we thank you for all your support. So please, do us a solid. Now, today's guest has been a part of the SAFTAcast since its inception well over a year ago. I am talking about the one and the only T.A. Noonan is finally here on the program, stepping out from behind the shadows of this program to talk about a good number of things, including her days in high school and the goofiness that ensued there, and her, I am sure she is not alone in this, communal fear of Robert Stack's Unsolved Mysteries, and some listener questions. Indeed, sometimes on Facebook at facebook.com/SAFTAcast and on Twitter at SAFTAcast, we solicit questions for our guests from our listeners. You comment, you tweet, we'll ask. No matter what the question is, we will ask them. And we had some doozies in this one. So pay attention to our Facebook page. Pay attention to us on Twitter. Now sit back and enjoy a wonderful conversation on today's birthday episode of the SAFTAcast, coming at you right after the theme song. So, T.A. Noonan, we finally have you on the show.
I don't know. I'm sorry. It's very funny to me. Hi. Yeah, I guess.
Well, I mean, we've wanted you on here for a while.
I didn't know that this was a thing that people wanted.
Well, no, it is. You know, people want to hear from you.
I don't know.
They do. Trust me on this.
Okay.
I've done my homework on this program.
Oh, fair enough.
Fair enough. I know our audience. So I got to start this off the way I start off every interview, and that is with the burning question that is on everyone's mind right now.
What is the burning question that is on everyone's mind right now?
How did this whole thing start? Meaning this SAFTAcast thing. You were there. You were at the... I know I'm the voice, but you were kind of the inception.
I don't remember if I don't know if I remember the story. I know you said you wanted to do radio stuff, or, well, I know you did a lot of radio stuff. You were on radio for what, 8 years?
Something like that.
Yeah, so you had done that for so long that it seemed kind of a crime to waste that skill of yours. I remember we did a workshop together where you were talking about performance and poetry readings and things like that. And it seemed kind of a waste to put... It seemed kind of a waste to... A waste of your abilities to not have you do something. And, of course, I listened to a lot of podcasts, and there were a lot of writing podcasts that were not super exciting. And so we decided to make you do this kind of thing. We put a gun to your head, except for the part where we totally didn't put a gun to your head.
I thank you for not putting a gun to my head.
Well, I could find one if you'd like me to do it.
I'm kind of okay without pistol near temple.
Oh, fair enough.
Depends on how you're going to shoot me, I guess. Back of the head. Execution style.
No, no. There would be too much blowback. That would be gross.
Yeah. Cleaning is a pain in the ass.
It is. Yeah. I don't like cleaning.
I agree. So what, you mentioned other podcasts. What podcasts do you listen to? I'm curious.
I listen to a lot of them. I listen to Welcome to Night Vale. That's one of my favorites. Let's see. The Nerdist. Though I don't listen to all of The Nerdist. I pick the ones that I want to listen to. I just went through Serial, which was pretty amazing. And I listen to a lot of NPR podcasts. Let's see. Ask Me Another. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I just started listening to TLDR and On the Media recently, and I like those. I gather a lot of bits and pieces from other NPR podcasts. I've got a ton of them that I listen to. I'm trying to remember the ones. I listen to Lou Reed's The Internet sometimes, but that one, I like falling asleep to it for the most part because Lou's got a very soothing voice. I don't necessarily like all of the things that he reads from. There's some pretty crazy stuff that he reads from because the internet is crazy.
I don't think he likes all of it either.
Well, I know he doesn't like because, you know, I just sort of enjoy when I'm listening to it. And he has these moments where he laughs at the ridiculousness of it all, or he reads something that is particularly awful and he's just like, oh, God. That amuses the hell out of me. But there are ones that I'll listen to, like, actually intently. I find the sort of weird occult ones to be the funniest for me to listen to, and the ones from Something Awful, because those tend to have a good amount of hilarity. So, you know, if there's someone talking about their awful roommates, then there will be a really funny story about an awful roommate. Or if they're talking about a bad or a, you know, bad or good breakups, then I can expect that those stories are going to be pretty funny.
Well, how did you get into the NPR ones? Because you have, like, you've listed, like, five or six of them. Like, what's the appeal of the NPR ones?
Oh, actually, it was my uncle. So let me sort of backtrack a little bit. I used to have a lot of long commutes. I still occasionally do. It's about 30 minutes or so from 30 to 45, depending on traffic and things, from where I live to where I teach. And I had a couple of other different points in my life where I'd had, you know, at least half-hour commute, so I'd listen to a lot of music. And I have one of those old, like, 4-gig iPods it still works, so I still use it. And I liked listening to that, and I had a CD player in my car, and I listened to CDs a lot, too. And I listened to it a lot, so much that I blew my speakers out, because I would listen to them very loud. So I blew my speakers out, and one day I was riding along with my uncle, and he was like, your speakers sound like shit. And I was like, because I blew them out. And he's like, well, I haven't bought you a present in a while. I guess, you know, you seem to listen to a lot of music, so I'm going to get you a good car stereo. And that had, a USB port in the front. And so that allowed me to plug in my iPod directly, which I did for a while. And he was like, you know, you can use flash drives in here. So he gave me a flash drive loaded up with a bunch of podcasts mostly from NPR, about things that I was interested in at the time. So there was a lot of stuff about Breaking Bad. There was a lot of stuff about Deadwood, though I don't actually watch Deadwood. I just was interested in it, which is sort of weird. And it just kind of got me into the habit of doing that. And then a couple of other people I know recommended other NPR podcasts, and I started adding them and adding them. So most of the places I've lived don't seem to... They'll have NPR affiliates, but they don't play any of the NPR stuff. They just mostly play classical music, so...
Yeah, it's like in Florida, where I am, you have the NPR station 1 broadcast like, okay, here's the morning news, here's the evening news, and the rest of the time is classical music. And in order to listen to any of the shows, you have to get the digital version, you know, whatever it is, NPR 2, digital, HD, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you need a whole new radio for that.
Yeah, I mean, mine will do digital stuff, I think, the stereo system, but I don't tend to listen to the radio very much, so I don't play around with it too much. I don't know. I know I can pick up digital stations, but I don't, or some of them I can. I think there might be some sort of extra kit that I need, and I think it will do, like, satellite radio, but I don't have that kit either. If there's one thing I really regret about that stereo is that I didn't get the Bluetooth, because at the time, I didn't have a fancy phone, so I couldn't do Bluetooth. I mean, I figured out a workaround so I can kind of do hands-free with my phone when I'm traveling or when I'm driving, but for the most part, but I don't have Bluetooth, so I have to actually set it up, which is a pain.
Whatever works, though.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a setup now. I end up screaming in my car a lot because the phone ends up being about 2 feet from my face. And, I mean, I can definitely talk loudly. I do that a lot. I have very poor volume control. But, yeah, no, I will put it in the little holder that I have that suction cup to my windshield, and then I'll be like, "Hello! I am screaming! Can you hear me?" And then everyone will hear me, and it seems to work out okay.
What a lovely singing voice you must have. I had to say that, you know.
Actually, I am terrible. I mean, I'll sing along in the car. Like, I'll sing all the time in the car. But I know I'm a terrible singer, so.
I have never seen you do karaoke.
I did that one time in Marquette. I did it once in St. Augustine. I did it once in Hattiesburg, but there were, like, 12 people doing it. So, like, you couldn't hear me, and I stood way in the back. So I think on...
What song was that?
I don't remember. I think it might have been Girls Just Want to Have Fun. I know that when I was in Marquette, I did Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. And when I was in St. Augustine, I did... Oh, gosh. What did I do? Oh, it was Paradise by the Dashboard Light by Meatloaf. I did the female parts.
So you had somebody to do the other part, though?
Yeah.
You didn't do a duet as one person?
No. I'm not that good.
That's fun to try.
I don't know. I love watching people do karaoke, and I have, like, a weird collection of songs that I know all the words to, but I can never really get over my own fears of... I mean, reading is not a problem, but, like, for karaoke, I can't get over it. Mostly because I am aware that I have a particularly odd range, and I don't sing very well, and I'm a good mimic, so if there's lyrics, I can modulate my voice so it sounds okay. But if it's just the music, then I don't have the music, I don't have the singer to give me a sense of where I am, so, or where my voice needs to be.
The best singing advice I ever got was from, I think it was Waylon Jennings, who said, "If you can't sing good, sing loud. And if you don't know the words, just hum."
It reminds me of, I can't remember, what was that?
That was my virus scanner just going, "Hey, I've completed my run."
Oh, okay.
I didn't find anything, so...
Oh, okay. Anyway. No, I was saying about, Oh, shoot, what was I talking about?
You can't sing good, sing loud.
Sing loud. Oh, yeah, so one of my dear old friends, when I was one of my former roommates from college, she had the most amazing CD collection, and in there she had this tribute to Black Sabbath. And one of them is... there's a cover of War Pigs, and it's a live cover. And I can't remember the name of the band... but I'm sure I could look this up at some point in the song, he gets... It's obvious that he's drunk or high or something. He is intoxicated in some fashion. And he completely forgets the lyrics and just goes, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, yeah, that's awesome.
It's not the guy from Typo Negative.
Mm-mm. No, but although Typo Negative is on that CD, I think... I can't remember what song it is that they do, but it's really early on the CD. It's like one or two, but that's you're thinking of the guy's name is Peter Steele. But yeah, Peter Steele and Typo Negative, they have a song on that album.
I wouldn't be surprised, honestly. That seems right up Peter Steele's alley.
Oh, I love Typo Negative. I was introduced to them by a roommate in high school. We had it was interesting because. I went to a residential high school, a boarding school for nerdy kids. If you've ever seen Real Genius, it's kind of like that, but with less, with fewer lasers and nuclear explosions.
And Val Kilmer.
And Val Kilmer, yeah, Val Kilmer wasn't there. It was kind of like that. And I had two roommates. One was someone I had gone to my first high school with. It was for juniors and seniors only. Someone I had gone to high school with in my freshman and sophomore
years.
Wait,
the boarding school was for juniors and seniors only?
Yeah.
Okay.
The high school I went to for my freshman and sophomore years was a local high school that had... It was sort of a weird situation because it was half local kids and half bussed in, and most of the people who were bussed in were not from that neighborhood. They were coming from primarily white neighborhoods, so they could try to desegregate them. If you know anything about the history of Baton Rouge, which is where I grew, spent a lot of time there, I kind of grew up there. I sort of consider New Orleans and Baton Rouge my areas. But anyway, the school was like, the neighborhood was mostly African American, and they would bus white kids in from other neighborhoods. So that was how they achieved a desegregation, except that it was deeply, there was all kinds of problems. And if you do some research on the Baton Rouge desegregation, it's a fucking nightmare. I hate that whole thing. But, I mean, I loved the school in a lot of ways. It was weird, but it was a lot of fun. The first person who was my first roommate when I was in my boarding school was someone I had gone to that high school with. I ended up moving out because she developed some health problems that made things difficult for her to live with another person.
Yeah.
So I moved out and I got another roommate, and this was my friend who introduced me to Typo Negative, Shelley. And Shelley, the suite number was O, or they were all lettered. I guess they were suite letters, but they were suites that they have three rooms in them with a shared bathroom. And
like a communal lounge area.
Well, it didn't have a communal lounge. Okay. The floors had communal lounges, but the suites themselves, it was kind of like being in a very tiny three-bedroom apartment, and each bedroom was a pair of students. Some students had single rooms. They were uncommon. But we had, in that suite, there were four other girls, but there was also me and Shelley, and it was suite O, and we were all kind of crazy. So we decided to call it Sweet Anarchy. So we put like the anarchy symbol in the O, and our poster, like most people had on their walls, like the sort of standard college student posters, and we had like pictures of like Tool and Typo Negative, that kind of stuff.
Bob Marley and the famous John Belushi drinking the Jack Daniels with the college word.
Yeah. It was kind of like that. That's what we had then. And Skittles ads. Everybody had Skittles. Well, not everybody. Skittles ads were sort of a way that you sort of subtly communicated that you were... But everyone knew. It was like an unspoken thing. But if you saw someone... If someone had a Skittles ad on their wall, it meant that they were queer. So the women would have them, the men... I don't know if the boys had them. I think it was definitely something the women did. I think I only went into the boys' dormitory, except in their communal space that was open once. We did a trick-or-treating there. This was before, I think, they allowed visitation, but... at that time, it was like, you did not get to go into the boys' dormitory. You could go into their lobby, but you couldn't go into the dormitories. And I think my senior year there, they did a test thing where girls got to trick-or-treat in the men's dormitory, and then the men got to trick-or-treat in the women's dormitory. And
when was this? 1978?
It was 1990. Well, it would have been 97. So I graduated in high school from 1998. So it was 1997, Halloween.
So, yeah, because I'm from the Northeast, and we never had that issue. I mean, when I went to college, all the dorms were co-ed.
Oh, I mean, we had, when I went to LSU for undergrad, I mean, we had men's and women's dormitories, but this was, I mean, this was high school, and there were a lot of concerns about, you know, crazed teenage hormones and things like that. But yeah, that was, we had the Skittles ads, all the, if you went into a girls' dormitory room and you saw a Skittles ad, that was the way they would identify, or you would let people know. It's like, oh, this person's a lesbian or bisexual or whatever. So we had two of them, one for me and one for Shelley, and then we also, you know, and there were several other ones, you know, scattered throughout the dormitories, and this was kind of how we communicated that. I mean, it was pretty crazy for, I mean, a Southern high school that we had that kind of ability to identify, and everyone was really cool about it.
Yeah, because it's still the late 90s you're talking about here. Yeah. I mean, I know that, you know, it's gotten more, you know, we've gotten better, but yeah, this is Louisiana, late 90s. Actually, that's kind of a cool fact.
Yeah, I mean, we had, actually there was a woman, I think her name was Mary, who she and her girlfriend successfully petitioned to allow women to wear tuxedos as opposed to gowns. We had formals, like most places do. But I think it was my senior year that they made the decision, and there was actually a huge protest. Because I feel like it was the spring formal, or maybe it was Valentine's Day, or what is that, Sadie Hawkins, something like that. I forget. But it was winter formal. One of them had petitioned, I think it was Mary, petitioned to wear a suit, and they said no. Because the guidelines stated, oh, women have to wear formal dresses, and men could wear formal. So there was a group of both young men and women, men who wore dresses, because actually the men's didn't say anything about the dresses, but the women specifically stated dresses, men just said formal wear. So they wore formal gowns, and a bunch of women came dressed in suits, showed up and were turned away at the door. And then a bunch of men came in dresses, but they had to let them in. And they realized that this was completely silly, and so they pulled that rule. And so by prom, it just stated formal wear for men and women.
Then you lead a new protest, because what defines formal wear? Because if I'm working in health services, I'm part of a hazmat team or something, formal wear for me is a hazmat suit.
We didn't have that. Well, maybe we had hazmat suits. I don't know where they would have been. I mean, maybe in the science areas.
Well, now, you know, this is also late 90s, so you don't have Amazon. You can't just go on there and buy hazmat suits.
That's true. Actually, we were pretty internet savvy for that time period. We got ourselves banned from the U.S. Postal Service's website. Like, all of our IP addresses were blocked because we decided... So, we did a lot of pranks. And one of the ones that really caught on was the Postal Service tape prank. Basically, that you would get rolls of... You could order packing materials online, and they were free. So we didn't have a full working post office. We just had, like, a little room where you could drop off your mail. So if you wanted to mail packages or anything like that, you had to buy your own postal stuff. And then we found out you could order this stuff online, so that's what we did. So we ordered boxes and tape and things like that. Well... One guy had ordered a couple of rolls of the Postal Service tape, the priority mail tape. And he had those rolls, and he started doing things where he would... I don't remember who it was who started the prank. But he started going around into... I think it was professors' or teachers' cubicles where they would grade for their office hours and things. Or something like that. And just started taping across their entranceway so they couldn't get in unless they cut the tape. And then this sort of caught on. And so there was a series of pranks that involved postal mailing tape. There was one where a guy, in fairness, he volunteered, where he did a handstand on a chair. Then they taped him to the wall and left him there upside down for a while. Which, he volunteered. He stood on his head did a handstand on a chair so he could do this. There was one where there was a student who had his... we had those recessed doors, and they would swing in. So they taped up the recessed door and then filled it with packing peanuts and then taped over it. So when he opened the door, the peanuts fell in, and then he had to bust through the tape. People would tape things to people's ceilings and walls, besides themselves, obviously.
Like chairs.
Chairs, desks. I think one person managed, like, I think there was someone who was like a tennis player who taped the tennis racket to the ceiling. I forget. There was all kinds of ridiculousness. And eventually the Postal Service caught on that we were ordering so much tape. And I guess they contacted the people in charge, the administration. And when they contacted the administration, they were like, oh, yeah, so they've been pulling all these pranks with the tape. And they were like, okay, we'll just block their IP addresses. So nobody could order postal supplies anymore. So we had to have, I think somebody, one of the RAs, agreed to make runs to the local post office to go pick up materials if they were needed. To be fair, though, if I remember correctly, at maximum density, I think there were 5 or 6 cases of priority mail tape floating around in the dormitories between the men's and women. So I don't think we actually needed the tape anymore, or we didn't need it to for many years.
Were there other pranks you guys pulled? You're talking like it's real genius and everything, and that film is just full of like goofy pranks and such using nerds.
We had a lot of, most of them were not super destructive. There were very strict rules about what you could and could not do in your dorm rooms. For example, you couldn't use thumbtacks. You had to use, what is that, sticky tack stuff?
Yeah.
The poster tack, the sticky stuff that you put on the backs of posters.
It looks like Play-Doh, but it's sticky.
Yeah. That was a cottage industry in and of itself was sticky tacks, because you weren't allowed to frame anything. You weren't allowed to use nails or thumbtacks or anything like that. So you had to use the sticky tack. I don't think you could use tape. You couldn't use tape either. And you couldn't use tape because the tape would strip the paint.
I'm guessing guessing they didn't have like the 3M contact tape at the time.
No. We just had the sticky tack. So we had that. So we couldn't be too destructive because we would... And we had weekly... nightly check-ins and weekly inspections or room inspections. You had to keep your room to a certain level of cleanliness, and they would check to make sure that you didn't have any contraband and things like that. So you couldn't get too destructive. There was no... So we didn't like freeze the floor or anything like that. I wish we had. We did have outdoor events that were pretty gross and fun. Maybe I'll tell one of those later, but... So the very first day I was there, the very first weekend, rather, we had a thing called Watermelon Slip and Slide.
Okay.
Where it was just basically a lot of slip and slides down a hill, and they ran they put dish soap on it and ran, you know, hoses down them, of course. And what you would do is you would pick up a watermelon, like a full-sized watermelon, and you would basically fling yourself down the hill holding the watermelon. And the watermelon was supposed to give you extra weight so you would propel down faster. But within about 10-20 minutes, the base of the slide had turned into this mud pit, you know, not unlike, you know, Woodstock or something. And so people were coming back up with these, like, mud-covered watermelons, and they had mud caked in their hair and everything. We were super gross. And then we went back to the dormitories, everybody did, and we broke all of the plumbing because... Everybody just went straight into the showers to rinse off, and no one thought that the grass and mud and stuff would clog up the plumbing. So we ruined the showers in the dorms for about 2 days. There were a lot of toilet paper pranks because we would have the, weekly room inspection, we'd also get our weekly toilet paper ration. We used to call that the TP fairy. So you'd hear like, TP fairy! And someone would throw toilet paper in your dorm room. So I think it was... I feel like it was for the... It was something like 2 rolls per girl per week, which is not enough. Almost everybody had a toilet paper stash. Like, everybody kept... Like, would go to Walmart and have a toilet paper stash. There were all kinds of pranks. There was one I got in trouble for, which we did dramatic readings of Weekly World News in the Walmart. Like, we just stood on top of things and started doing dramatic readings from Weekly World News. There was the Apple tennis game... which was pretty destructive, actually. We would microwave apples and hit them with tennis rackets and see how much they would explode. And that worked out pretty well. There was always somebody... There were the soda wars. The soda wars mostly consisted of everyone picking their favorite soda and finding out which one was the most carbonated. So you'd shake it up and you'd throw it out, and you would have somebody like measure, like record and measure how high it exploded up. And then,
nerds.
Yeah, pretty much. Winner was Diet Dr. Pepper. We also had a hairiest legs contest, which was supposed to be for the men. but several women entered it, and one got first runner-up. So that was pretty impressive. Yeah, there was all kinds of goofy stuff that we did.
So you were only there, though, for 2 years?
2 years. I mean, there are people there. You can't live with people like that and not... There are people I met there that I'm still, you know, very, very close to. Some of my oldest friends are from there. Yeah, I mean, it's such a strange experience. Like, a lot of people are like, you know, and I recognize that a lot of nerdy kids have really bad high school experiences, and I was really lucky that I didn't, because everybody was nerdy. So it was just, what were you nerdy about?
Yeah, because I can attest, you know, I discovered, like, Dungeons & Dragons in 8th grade, and that basically destroys you. You discover it in junior high, and it's like, okay, I put it this way. At the end of high school, I was second from the bottom on the totem pole. There was one group worse than me, but I was damn near close.
I mean, well, we had Dungeons & Dragons games that we would do, D&D games, in the lobbies. For some reason, I think we mostly did them in the women's lobby. I don't think because... For any major reason other than I think it was slightly bigger. If you were stuck, there was a video game cabinet there. And I can't remember, I think it was 1942. It was some flight game, like you would play a plane and you would shoot things. But it wasn't one of the, like, in space ones. It was supposed to, but it was something like that. And there was this game in, you know, this video game cabinet in the women's lobby that wasn't in the men's. So I think we did it there just because we had that. That, and I think there was an attached kitchen. I feel like the men's dormitory didn't have an attached kitchen to the lobby. But I could be wrong about that. I might be misremembering.
Have you ever gone back to this place?
Not in years. Everybody keeps asking me if I have, or... And I mean this mostly when I say everybody. I mean people who went to the school with me. I don't think I've been back in a long time. And I know it's changed a lot. When we were there, I mean, just to put this into perspective, like, nobody had cell phones. And we didn't have phones in the rooms either. So you had to go onto the hallway and you had to use the payphone, and people would, like, fucking stalk the payphone. I mean, like, you would get a friend of yours, like, I've got to finish this paper, but I really need to call my boyfriend, so I need you to guard the payphone for me. You get some people who would just sit there and, like, you know, just hang on to the, you know, sit there by the payphone and, like, no, you can't use it. No, you can't use it. I'm waiting for a call. And
I'll give you 3 rolls of packing tape. If you stay by the phone for 20 minutes.
And I was like, I'll give you some toilet paper and some sticky tack. I'll give you 2 rolls of toilet paper and a pack of sticky tack and 4 rolls of priority mail tape if you'll guard the phone for me for 2 hours.
That's like prison almost.
I know, it's...
Instead of cigarettes, it becomes sticky tape. You know, sticky tack is your commodity.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was plenty of... you know, quote-unquote illegal activity. I mean, there were people who smoked and there were people who did, you know, who drank and did things that you expect crazy teenagers to do. It was just that there was a lot more oversight. So it was really tricky to do it.
But there was still a black market, too.
There was still a black market. And there was a way, you know, there were, like, I accidentally found myself in the black market. So if you had a driver's license, they would have photocopy of your driver's license on file, because that meant that you could drive, and they had to have that paperwork on file. I did not have a driver's license until I was 19, but I had a state-issued ID, like one of the just ID cards that you could get. And I turned 18 March of 1998, but that meant I had 3 months, or was 2 months, or 2 months and change, of excellent purchasing ability, because at this time the legal drinking age was 18 and the smoking age was 18, so I could buy both cigarettes and alcohol. So when people found out about my birthday, I suddenly was like, became one of those people who was like, hey, do you think you could go pick me up a pack of Marlboros? And I was like, what the yes, maybe.
Pack of Marlboros is worth 3 packs of sticky tape.
Well, I mean, there was all kinds of black and market, crazy market dealing. But yeah, I mean, there was a lot of crazy stuff that went on. I mean, I actually, you know, I was no angel, but, I was deeply paranoid. So, especially because I grew up kind of, with this sort of, I mean, I love, conspiracy theories and weird stuff like that. And I grew up, watching a lot of Unsolved Mysteries. So... Unsolved Mysteries kind of shaped my paranoia for years.
There's something about Robert Stack on that show.
Oh my god. Robert Stack, I swear, every once in a while I'll be taking a shower and I will hear Robert Stack narrating my life. Like, you know, she went into the bathroom to take a shower. And I'm like, oh shit, I'm going to be kidnapped by aliens any second now. Because that's what's going to happen in this narrative that is being constructed in my head.
And then you suddenly see, like, this stock person sitting in a chair going, I knew the shower water was going to come out pretty soon and be warm, but I was not sure how long it would take. And then you cut back to the shower.
Or something like that. Yeah. It was really weird. Actually, part of the reason why I was so freaked out by it is because I actually knew someone who was on Unsolved Mysteries as, like, a fraudster.
Whoa.
Yeah, someone who was, like, because they do the true crime ones. You know, they had a lot of the, like, you know, mysterious angels and urban legends and alien abductions and things like that. But they also had, like, real criminal cases. And one of them was a fraud case. A man who had defrauded a bunch of people on this, like, prototype three-wheeled car. I can't remember the name of the car. It doesn't really matter. But anyway, in the story, he also dressed as a woman. And so, I mean, and keep in mind, this is early, so the terminology they used, of course, is all kinds of jacked up. But he would cross-dress, and, you know, he would dress as a woman. And at one point in the process, or in the story, they're showing, like, what he would look like, you know, the future thing.
The digital, you know, like, in, you know.
Oh, the artist rendition. Yes, the artist rendition.
This is how he would have aged.
Yeah, this is the artist rendition of what he would look like now. And the artist rendition was, you know, they had a picture of him, you know, looking like a dude. And they were like, this is what he would look like as a woman. Eventually, like, they did the update. And it turned out that he had surgeries and was living
He had transitioned,
and I had met her. She worked in flowers in some way, shape, or form. Was involved in the florist industry in some way, shape, or form. And my mother's boyfriend had a Christmas party or reception or something like that, and I had met her briefly. And I was young, so I was kind of a jerk, as young people are wont to be.
Wait, you're probably like, Unsolved Mysteries, so you're probably like, what, about 10 or so?
10, 12, something like that. But I remember thinking that, one, I didn't think she was very pretty. And that, two, she had this bag. It was a purse. It was a white leather purse. It might have been fake leather, but it looked like leather to me. And it was dirty. And I remember thinking to myself, why would you have such a dirty bag? If you have a white bag, wouldn't you want it to be clean?
Especially at, like, a big public function like this.
Yeah, you know, so I remember, and so I actually recognized. And then that just was like, if that's true, then all the other things must be true, too. And so I completely freaked out. So I was sure that aliens were going to come and get me. And so, basically, I kind of grew up with a huge paranoia, like, conspiracy theory streak that now I can kind of rationalize, but I still find myself absolutely fascinated by conspiracy theory stuff. I will fall into black holes reading that stuff.
Wiki wormholes.
There was one that I saw recently that I ended up reading for, like, 3 or 4 hours. It was about, like, this, you know, Illuminati kind of conspiracy thing. I remember being on board with it. I'm like, all right. I'm on board with your crazy. Cool. And then there's this part about how there's this whole section about women. And I'm like, okay, what role do women play in this new world order? Click. And I click on this thing and I read that basically women are too feeble-minded to be part of the new world order. And that it is the men's responsibility to turn them away from capitalism and shopping and fashion and makeup because it's going to ruin their brains and they're basically inferior, and so it is our job to usher them away from all. And I was just like, nope, you lose, click, and I close.
Did they just, like, read The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood or something?
I don't know, but it was terrible. Like, it was, that was when I was just like, okay, I was on board with your conspiracy theory, at least in terms of being amused by it, until you turned into misogynistic assholes, and I will not deal with that. Sorry, close.
I would think that's, like, SOP almost for conspiracies, that it's very misogynist.
I mean, you'd be surprised. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of conspiracy theory stuff that's pretty misogynistic. But there's some that aren't. But they still sort of hinge on this sort of false dichotomy of, you know, gender binaryism, like the ones that are very much, quote-unquote, matriarchal, I guess, for lack of a better way to put it, tend to imagine women very much in that sort of binary, like, masculine versus feminine. Women are delicate and beautiful and blah, blah, blah. And it just makes me crazy, you know. And I think a lot of that, I mean, certainly a lot of that comes out of the, you know, that, you know, the pushback on sort of, you know, quote unquote matriarchy versus patriarchy, or masculine versus feminine, when of course we know that that's all problematic and all socially constructed and blah, blah, blah. But we're not here to theorize.
No, we're not here to theorize. We're here to talk about how batshit conspiracy there is, Sork.
I love conspiracy theories, though. They're so fun. One of my favorite books I used to keep in the bathroom, it actually wasn't mine, it was one of my exes, but we kept it in the bathroom, was like the encyclopedia of conspiracy theories, and we used to keep it on the the toilet tank and grab it and read passages through it when we were in the toilet. Sometimes we would just shout them across the house, be like, let me tell you about this weird UFO conspiracy,
let me tell you about the Birdmen of Tahoe. You know, I don't even know if that's conspiracy. I think I made that up.
Let me tell you about the Mothman prophecies. It was great.
I don't see how conspiracy theories can survive in the age of the internet.
Well, actually, I think it's the exact opposite. It's the very thing, you know, that allows them to continue to circulate. Because unless you know how to, you know, vet your sources and blah, blah, I tell my students this kind of thing all the time. But unless you know, you can make something that seems very, very, very credible. You can make something that seems very, very credible, but is actually not, but looks like it is.
Time cube. For example. I mean, it looks like it's legit when you first look at it, and so you start reading it, and it's completely batshit insane.
Yes. It's conspiracy theories have taken on like a whole new life on the internet. I mean, for a long time, I found them online too, but you would find, you know, I would buy conspiracy theory books and things like that, usually used, because, you know, why would I spend full price? Why would I pay full price for that?
I'm not going to pay $20 for this. I'll pay $2.
Yeah. And that was a lot of fun. I mean, that was the kind of stuff we would keep around for
toilet reading.
Toilet reading for shits and giggles, literally and figuratively.
Shit reading, you know?
Yeah, it was fun though. I mean, that was a good. We had other things in the bathroom. I mean, there was that. There were other like stupid, you know, catalogs and things like that. But mostly conspiracy theory reading for a long time.
I'd be fascinated to know more writers what they have in their bathroom, what their bathroom reading is, because I know writers, I know educators, and it seems like you'd think, oh, you go in there and there's like all this high-powered stuff. Like, they keep Foucault in the bathroom. No, they usually keep crap like that.
Yeah, I mean, all the stuff that I would keep in the bathroom was silly stuff. Oh, which vaguely, it's why I sort of laugh every time when, for anyone who's listening to this who's not watched Breaking Bad or has not finished it yet, you might want to turn your sound off for a second. So, spoiler alert. Whenever, oh god, now I can't remember the character's name. The brother.
Yeah.
Yeah, when he goes into Walter White's bathroom and he has
Leaves
of grass in the bathroom. I'm like, no one keeps leaves of grass in the bathroom!
Unless they want to use toilet paper. I shouldn't dub on it. It's one of my favorite pieces of lit, but we're not here to discuss it.
Yeah, no. I just was like, don't keep that in the bathroom, especially a signed nice copy. I mean, don't put that in the bathroom. That just made me angry.
I keep The Onion in my bathroom. The Onion ad nauseum books.
Oh, yeah.
It's easy stuff. So I want to get into this now. We have a lot of listener questions.
Whoa.
To get into. We solicited questions from our listeners, and yeah, we're going to keep, hopefully in the future, more will do this. And cool. So now a couple of these you know and a few you don't. So coming to us from the internet now, I'm pulling it up right now because I got a list here. So we got a couple off of Twitter. I'll start with those. From Cat Poetic, she wanted to ask you, some days combing through Submittable, which for our non-writer listeners is basically a submission service that tracks your submissions, so you, like a spreadsheet basically. Some days combing through Submittable feels like cleaning a chicken coop. It's cathartic and crappy. What are your insights and comments?
It is like cleaning a coop. I end up, like, sometimes I get, like, really obsessive about Submittable, and I'll just hit refresh over and over again. because I just expect that suddenly, like, my status will change and I'll freak out about it. That's
from, like, pending to accepted.
In progress or accepted or rejected or whatever. A lot of times I actually tend to use it to go find things. For example, I have a bad habit. I'm trying to get better about it. For a long time, I would keep templates for cover letters and for bios that you would put in there, that kind of thing. Like, so I had a short bio, a long bio, a detailed cover letter, a brief cover letter. I had a lot of templates. And now, because most of that stuff is available online from various submission managers, you can pull up records. You could pull up what you've sent them, which is bad in some ways, because then I go like, oh God, I totally had a typo or something. But it's useful if I'm like, oh man, I should just go find, use this bio that I used for this other submission, because I try to keep track of everything. You know, I'm not very organized, but I pretend to be. Someday maybe it'll actually stick. So that's one of the things. So I end up doing that, but cleaning it out, like going through and sort of checking things off and everything. It's both crappy because I get to see like how I'm doing, positive or negative, but I also get to see, but then I have to, you know, kind of wade through the shit and then I look at it and then I feel better after I'm done. And that's kind of like when I clean the chicken coop too. It's like, it's a horrendous and awful job because it smells and it's gross and basically you're just scooping poop. Lots and lots of it. When you're done, I mean, afterwards, most of the time I use pine, but I lay down the pine shavings and it smells fresh and clean in there. And I'm like, ah, oh, that's so nice. And then, of course, almost invariably, the chickens come back in. I let them come back in and then they go and they shit on it. And I'm like, ah, oh, I did such a, I worked so hard to clean this. But it is, I mean, and I know it's good for them. It's good for me. I mean, like, you can't just let them, you can't just wallow in it. You have to clean stuff out, I guess.
Definitely. I agree. Next question comes to us from Sandra Poetry, also on Twitter. Where do you buy your jewelry? Because I know you quite a bit. You've often said you feel naked without wearing necklaces, rings, etc. So where do you buy your jewelry? Because you have the most amazing stuff.
Well, thank you. I make a lot of it. I forget. I think I was like 10 or something like that when I first started making jewelry. And I remember when I was in high school, because, God, I was such a nerd. I was in Junior Classical League, which is basically like Latin quiz bowl. Well, that's Kertamen's Latin quiz bowl, but basically it was like Latin stuff all the time. And they had an art contest, and one of the things that I did was I made this necklace, like the Siren's necklace or something, and it was made out of fake pearls and abalone and stuff like that, and I won like second prize for, I think it was for multimedia. I think they just put jewelry in multimedia, I guess. But I kind of started doing it when I was younger, and I don't think I have very many pieces I made when I was younger because most of it was very, very cheap. But I have a lot of pieces now that I've made. I try to support other jewelry makers too, buy pieces that they make, or people buy for me. I like to support people who do this sort of stuff, artisans and such. And sometimes I'll buy things that I know that I could make myself, but I just like it so much that I'm like, yeah, whatever, I'll fucking buy it.
Saves you the time and work and effort.
Yeah, well, that's part of my thing, is that I get so, I'm in this constant state of, like, obsession, where I'll do one thing over and over and over again. So if I get into a jewelry making kick, I will just make jewelry all the time, which is why I end up with a bunch of pieces. I'll make one piece and I'm like, oh, that was fun. I'll make another, and I'll make another one. And suddenly I have like 12 necklaces and 18 pairs of earrings. And I rarely make bracelets for myself. I usually make them for other people because I end up, I bang them a lot. So I always feel like they're going to break. I'll do stuff like that and I'll just go crazy for a long time. And then I will stop doing it for a while and then I'll pick it back up. So a good amount of my jewelry is stuff that I've made for myself. Then, you know, or other people have made either for me or just made and I bought.
You're not the type to go like to a K's or some jewelry store and buy stuff. You're more arts and crafts style.
Oh yeah. I mean, I have some nice pieces that are, you know, fancy, fancy pieces, but most of those are vintage or were gifts. I have a ring that I wear that has diamonds on it that is part of my grandmother's wedding set.
Oh, that's different.
Yeah. And I have I don't wear it very much because I actually need to get it resized, but I have an aquamarine, because I was born in March, so I have an aquamarine. It's really, really pretty, but it's a little big, and I don't wear it very much. Although it is like a fancy jewelry piece, it is one that it was actually made by a jeweler. It's not like a K's piece. Like, this guy who made it is actually a jewelry smith, and he went ahead and made it. I get a lot of gift. Jewelry is a very popular gift. Like, I have a lot of friends who buy me jewelry. And then every so often, I get into these things where I want to buy, like, junk jewelry. Like, just basically silly stuff.
Costume jewelry?
Yeah, costume jewelry. I always call it junk jewelry because my grandmother used to call it that. Yeah, it's costume jewelry. Every once in a while, I'll want some of that stuff. And so I'll either buy it at, like, thrift stores or, like, discount places. So, you know, like, if I go to, like, Kohl's or something like that, I'll sometimes pick up something really funky. Crazy funky. The funkier, the better. And I try to go, I try to have an excuse to wear funny, goofy stuff whenever I can.
All right, so we got a couple from Facebook.
Okay.
Apparently this person knows you a little bit here, knows you're a Sailor Moon fan.
Okay.
If you were a pretty Sailor's guardian, who would you be?
Oh, God.
So,
the standard rule for deciding which of the senshi you are is to pick the one that you look most like. And I used to look a lot like Jupiter. I mean, I had brown hair. I have brown hair. It's brown and gray now because I'm getting old. And I had that length. I had that ponytail. So for a long time, I just sort of was like, oh, I would be Jupiter. Except that Jupiter, I love Jupiter, but she's not my favorite. And then there's the ones that I would aspire to. Like, I always aspired to be like Sailor Neptune because she was so cool. She was pretty. She was artistic. But also, you know, physically accomplished. You know, she was physical, just awesome. And I thought she was the coolest. And so I wanted to be like her. So I would like to say that I would be Sailor Neptune, but I don't think that would work. I am pretty goofy and klutzy, so I feel like I'm more like maybe Sailor Moon. But I think ultimately, if I were one of them, I would probably be Sailor Venus, because I don't tend to think of myself as a leader, so for Sailor Moon I would not be very good at being in charge. But Sailor Venus is cool when she wants to be, but is also like a complete goofball, and very much like Usagi, very much like Sailor Moon, and in fact is supposed to be kind of like her body double, is supposed to be like the decoy for her.
She's like second in command.
Kind of, sort of, you know, yeah. She's the one that's supposed to be the leader of the senshi, the inner senshi. So I feel like that would be closer to who I actually would be. I mean, if we're talking aspirational, I would totally be Sailor Neptune. But if we're talking about who I probably am, it would probably be Sailor Venus. And if we're talking about who I look most like, at one point it was Jupiter, but now I don't have long hair anymore. So I guess the closest would be one of the short-haired ones. So I would have to probably say Sailor Uranus. So, Haruka, I guess that would be the one I guess I physically look most like.
Got another question for you. What is your favorite medieval weapon, and why?
What is my favorite medieval weapon? Mm-hmm. Oh my God. I don't know.
See, this is the thing I say on Facebook and on Twitter, you know, ask us anything. You ask me, I'll ask the guest.
That's so amazing.
Your favorite medieval weapon, and why?
Okay, this is not the question I anticipated answering.
Welcome to the Saftacast.
I did not anticipate. I think my favorite is the Morning Star. I mean, that thing is badass. I don't think it's a weapon I could use myself or anything, because I know how I am. I would, like, you know, swing it around and I'd, like, take my face off or something.
You'd be like Wicked in Return of the Jedi.
But I just keep... That actually reminds me, since you mentioned Return of the Jedi, reminds me of when they had the Star Wars promo that came out, and they had the lightsaber with the hilt, the cross hilt, and everyone was talking about that. I feel like there was somebody on the internet who made a joke about a lightsaber Morningstar. Like, instead of having the pointy bits, it had, like, little lightsabers coming out of it. And now I kind of want to see that if it doesn't exist. But I think it's the most badass weapon. I mean, I don't know how practical it is. Or I guess if you were a badass enough, you could make any weapon practical. But I wouldn't use it. I'm not very good at it or anything.
Well, good morning, sir, then. You know, don't have a proficiency in it, but it's okay.
It's pretty badass.
So apparently this next questioner delves at one of your interests, I know. In ancient Greek myth,
okay,
what would be your fatal flaw?
Oh, what would be my Achilles heel if I were Achilles?
What would be your undoing, and how would it happen?
Well, I know my undoing in general is that I just talk too much, so I'd either have, like, the sort of, you know, I think in, what is it, in role-playing systems, they call it Bard's Tongue. I feel like I'd be like Cassandra. I would say things and they would come true, but no one would believe me. Or alternately, I would just say the wrong things at the wrong time. Like I wouldn't know when to keep my mouth shut, and then I would say something that would result in my ultimate demise. You know, I feel like one of those variations would probably be my fatal flaw.
So you'd piss off one of the gods by talking too much and say the wrong thing at the wrong time.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm pretty sure that would be it.
So you'd be the Larry David of Greek myth.
Don't gross. I don't want to be Larry David.
Well, we'll start on body parts then for a moment. I'll go to this question from one of our listeners. Nail/extremity coatings, decorations, jewelry, and tools. Are your digits weaponry? If so, how so?
What? I mean, sometimes I paint my nails. I've bitten my nails for a long time. I go through phases where I'll stop biting them for a while, and then I'll start doing it again. So they're never really weaponry. Although I did have a roommate who did that. She would sharpen her nails in case she needed to poke somebody or something, I guess. But they're not really... I mean, mostly I use my hands for work and my nails. I mean, I paint them occasionally because I like doing that occasionally, but I'm so hard on my hands that it never stays. So I end up with, I did this recently. I was gonna go and do this reading, and I was like, I'm gonna be all pimped out. And so I actually went ahead and did I gave myself a manicure, and I was very proud of my manicure, and I kid you not, 12 hours later it was ruined just by doing, you know, what I do on a daily basis.
Farm work.
Farm work, carrying stuff around, just, you know, subconscious or unconscious, I guess, nibbling and that kind of thing. So I look down and there's this huge chip and four of them. And I'm like, I spent 3 hours doing this. Cause I'm just I have to do one nail and then let it dry before I can do any other one. So it takes me hours to do it because I have to go one nail at a time. And I can't just do all of my hand and then just sit there and do nothing for a while.
So your digits are weaponry, but not because of decoration. Your rings, I guess, could smash somebody pretty hard.
This is a bad habit of mine. I have had several rings that I've worn in different times, and I love big rings. I think they're fun and funky, and I love them as statement ring things. But I can't, the bigger they are, the more likely I am to hurt myself with them. This is another reason why I can't keep my nails very long. One time I went somewhere and I didn't understand what the woman was telling me about my manicure. And she gave me these really long acrylic nails. And I had claw marks on my face and poked myself in the eye a lot.
Ow.
Because I couldn't control them. They were unruly. I can't, and the problem with rings too. I do a lot of face palming. You know, my hands are near my face a lot, and I don't know why that is. I'm gesturey, I guess. And I still have the ring. I don't wear it anymore. I have one fairly large ring, but at least it's not heavy like this one was. My class ring from high school. I ordered a women's ring, and they sent me a men's ring. Which, in some ways, is kind of cool, because the men's ring was twice the size and twice the price. So it was monster ring. But I used to give myself bruises on my forehead from face palming, because I would hit my hand so hard against my face that I would get these little bruises all over my face. So people were like, what happened to you? And I'm like, I did this to myself, which is actually a weird thing. I get weird bruises sometimes and people are like, are you okay? And I'm like, no, I'm just really a klutz. I mean, I did this to myself. It's embarrassing, but it's true.
So you really are Sailor V then?
In that case, I guess I would be more like Sailor Moon because I'm pretty klutzy. But yeah, no, I really do stupid stuff like that. I still have that ring, and I mean, it means a lot to me, but I can't wear it anymore because it just... I will knock myself out with that ring. So
it's like you see something on the internet and you're just like, oh, really? Ow! Give yourself a facepalm and you knock yourself cold.
Yeah, I've done stuff like that. Not knocked myself cold. Although I hit my head a lot, which is probably me admitting that I'm partially concussed most of the time, which is not true. But I have a bad habit of not checking my, sometimes I have bad spatial awareness, and I have a bad habit of not checking where my head is going. So, you know, invariably I'll be working in the basement at the farm or grabbing things to go take care of the animals or something like that. And I won't be paying attention, and I'll whang my head on a low piece of wood or the tractor. I like to hit my head on the tractor a lot. I don't know why that is, but I invariably do it. I'll be standing near a doorway trying to, like, say, take off my shoes or something, and then I'll jerk up like, I got that shoe off, boom, hit a doorknob or something stupid like that.
Oh.
So I have a bad habit of doing these things. I guess it's just because I don't really pay I should have better spatial awareness or pay better attention to my surroundings, but usually I'm kind of floating off in my own little world. Where I'm like, la, 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 la. I was one of those kids that, like, I'd be reading a book and I'd walk into, like, a pole or something because I wasn't paying attention to where I was because I was so engrossed in the book. And this was a sort of ongoing thing when I was, I mean, even all the way through high school and up until college. I mean, I got better about it. I stopped reading while I walk sometime in college because of that. I was well known for this. Actually, I remember... I mentioned that I went to this boarding school. Before that, I went to this high school where we had multiple, you know, it was half neighborhood kids, half bused-in kids from the white neighborhoods. And I was in marching band, which was mostly students who were from the neighborhood. You know, so I actually would walk around in that neighborhood. I knew most of the people who lived in, knew a lot of the people who lived in it. Not most of them, but a lot of them, because I worked with their sons and daughters in the marching band. And, you know, I was very, you know, I was very well known for walking around in that neighborhood with a book in my hand, you know, or sometimes if it was I'd have a book in one hand and then like my clarinet case, I played clarinet, my clarinet case in the other, you know, stuff like that. And I can't tell you how many times I walked into light poles and things like that. And people would be like, you know, they would be like, you need to stop doing that. You need to put your book down and watch where you're going. It was funny. In a lot of ways, I liked that school. I have actually been back there more than I've been back my junior, senior nerd boarding school of choice.
Why is that?
Because it's closer. If you've ever seen the Steel Magnolias, the original version, it was shot in, it was based on a play, and it was shot in the place where it was set, which is Natchitoches, Louisiana. Natchitoches is about a 3-hour drive from Baton Rouge. And that meant that so if I wanted to go to Natchitoches, it takes a concerted effort for me to drive there. It's not somewhere you just end up randomly.
So Natchitoches is like western...
Northern Louisiana.
Okay. It's not near New Orleans.
No.
That,
it's like near Shreveport, I think is the closest city that most people probably know is Shreveport. But yeah, it's weird for me to watch Steel Magnolias because a lot of the extras are people who taught in my school. And also, because I lived there long enough, I recognize a lot of the streets and places, and I'm like, when they'll turn a corner, I'm like, that's not the street that connects to it. And I'm a big nerd about that.
I remember once watching, or you were telling me about it, and what's the one with the wedding scene? Where, at the beginning where Julia Roberts comes down the aisle?
Oh yeah, so if you're watching the scene, the wedding scene, sitting right behind Sally Field, the mom, is, I think, her disciplinarian. But my favorite is if you are watching the wedding scene, when Julia Roberts is coming down the aisle, you'll see on the very edge, there's a man in a maroon suit, and he's bald. And he turns around and sees her, and you can see him. And if you keep an eye on him and you watch very closely, you can watch as he angles out of the pew and, like, kind of, I keep leaning away from the mic because I'm physically doing this, like anyone can see this, but you can watch him lean out and kind of stare at Julia Roberts's ass, which we always thought was very, very funny, because that was Dr. Harkrider, one of the computer science teachers that we had, and so he would always we would always tease him about that. It was like, you know, so got to stare at Julia Roberts's ass, huh? You know, I mean, we were like, what, 16 years old, so of course we were like, that's so funny.
So he and Lyle Lovett have something in common. Okay, I got one more for you.
Okay.
I hate to go into poetry land here, but I gotta ask this one.
Uh-oh. All right.
So one of our listeners wants to know, when will we be able to consume poetry in animated GIF form?
When can we... Well, I mean, I'm sure there are people already doing stuff like that. I mean, I haven't done it. Although I should now. Damn. An animated GIF war. Well, I mean, I know there were some... There was a friend of mine... Oh, God, now I can't even remember his username. He used to make these really weird, artsy animated GIFs. But they were amazing. And, I mean, I know that there are people doing a lot of stuff in electronic journals that are, like, kinetic typography or things like that. It's not really a stretch to take something that's kinetic typography and make it into a GIF. Or anything that's, you know, you're doing in Flash and make it into a GIF. I think the difference there is skill set, and you have to have that skill set. And, I mean, it's changing, but I think for a fairly long time, or at least based on my observations from when I started paying attention to this stuff, it seemed like there was a big gulf between what people could do, or what writers could do digitally versus what they could do in print. And I think that separation is changing, like more and more people are getting skilled with different softwares and different abilities. So I don't think it's long. If there isn't already an animated GIF poem, and if there is, please, someone tell me. I want to see these animated GIF poems. But if there aren't people already doing that or haven't done that already, although I feel like there's got to be something on like electronic literature or something like that. If there aren't, I don't think it's very long before we'll see it.
Yeah, because I mean... With technology, it's going so fast. The mutation of poetry is constant.
Yeah.
So, actually, this expression provides a good segue, actually, here. So, one more question, and that is, what is your response, what are your responses to Hyacinth Girl Press's Thunderdome contest a while ago? Which, if I remember right, you won that.
I was one of the victors in Thunderdome.
So,
and...
let's explain for the listeners who don't know. What was this?
So... Well, we're in the right season for it because we're recording this in March, so March Madness is going on. But it was playing off of that idea of March Madness and brackets. Like, everybody's creating brackets for everything. There's one on, like, IO9 or something for best science fiction series or something like that. Or best series. I don't know exactly what the designation is. Though I heard the last time I heard, Twilight Zone was beating Buffy, and there was quite an outcry about that. I don't know if that's still the case. But, you know, when people make literature brackets all the time. So Margaret had taken all of the semi-finalists, all the sort of gone through the manuscripts and picked 32 of them that
chapbooks.
Were... Yeah, chapbook manuscripts that were ones that she was seriously considering publishing. And worked out a bracket where she was pitting chapbook against chapbook and it would be whoever came out. But of course... This wasn't going to be like, you know, March Madness or basketball. It was going to, she ended up calling it Thunderdome. I feel like it was Kristen Latour who might have had something to do with, or maybe it was Allie Marini Batts. I feel like it might have been Allie, actually, that kind of came up with the idea for a Thunderdome. But anyway, somehow the Thunderdome thing came to pass. And so as decisions were made and manuscripts were cut, you know, winners emerged in the brackets. So at the end, there was the final four. And the final four were the winners of Thunderdome, though there was one other one that was chosen as a sort of editor's choice, separate one. But that was a lot of fun. It was a lot of, there was a lot of, like, you know, good-natured ribbing and smack-talking and things like that. And, you know, conversations about eating each other's faces, which was hilarious.
So the writers kind of know each other then.
Well, I mean, I think... I feel like I knew like half of the people who were in those brackets. I mean, maybe not personally, but had interacted with them online or had you know, had been in magazine, you know, had been published in the same magazines. I feel like I sat down and figured it out, and it was something like I knew at least a third of them in person or significantly enough online that I felt like I could go, "Yes, I know this person."
I know of them.
And there were a few others that I was like, I know this person's work. I don't necessarily know them. And I actually ended up meeting and, you know, engaging with more of them online because of Thunderdome, which was a lot of fun. There was a lot of silliness that to be had. But I'm super excited because I love Hyacinth Girl, and I was so glad to be a part of it. So
yeah, we've had Margaret on before. We got to have her. We've talked to her already. We're going to try and get her on again.
Oh, please. Margaret is awesome.
As maybe our first Redux guest.
Yes, you know. You should definitely do that. Do I have any kind of you know, authority on that subject? Because then I could order you to be like, yes, you must do this.
Well, I mean, you've kind of been with the show since the beginning here, in some form or another.
I guess. Mostly, I just yell at you in behind the scenes.
Yeah, I know. I have my bosses. I'm not kidding, folks, when I say that, you know, the ratings on this show, man. I'm not joking about that stuff. So we are almost out of time, though.
Aw.
I know. Goes by so fast. It's what many people tell me on this show.
I know. It's
like we get into it, and people are like, I'm so nervous when I sit down to do this. And then, like, after they're done, like, that was it? I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, I know, for real.
Like, that's what I was afraid of? Having a conversation? I'm like, yeah. So before we get out of here, though, before we call it, what do you got coming down the pike? I know AWP's coming up. We've been talking about that on the show recently. So you're going to be there. I'm going to be there.
Yep.
What else is coming out? You got any work coming out? Want to promote?
I've got some stuff coming out, individual journals in April and a few other things I'll be doing. I lose track of everything until it happens, and I'm just like, oh, yeah. I will be having my chapbook that won in Thunderdome, or was one of the winners of Chapbook Thunderdome, with Hyacinth Girl coming out this year, the Midway iterations, and it should be out, I think, in September? I could be wrong about the date, but it's something like that. And then next year I'll have this book of weird-ass Horus translations coming out with Noctuary Press, which I'm super excited about. That's been a project I've been working on for years and has gotten me really excited about translation again in a way that I wasn't before. But anyway, I don't want to get into the writing stuff because that's not our job.
No, this is the promotion part. I just really got into
I want to do more translation work, so maybe there will be more of that to come. But
maybe
in the meantime, I'm doing that and I'm working on some other stuff, and maybe that'll appear, maybe not. I mean, I don't think it's going to be finished anytime soon, but I mean, I've got some stuff coming out in some journals. I've got a chapbook coming out later this year, another book coming out next year, so...
You're like a machine.
I'm not a machine. Like, that's, like, one of those things that I'm always really paranoid about. Get back to my paranoia.
Conspiracy theory. You're not actually a human poet. You are a machine.
I am definitely not a machine. I spend years like working on things and then they all seem to come out together in a weird way. So, I do sit on my work a long time. It's a weird thing that happens. I like everything I work on takes years to do. It's just that it all seems to come out. I end up sitting on my work for a really long time and then I'm like, oh shit, I have like a whole bunch of stuff, and all of a sudden it all comes out at once or something. So
it different ways for different writers. So before we go though, where can the folks find you online?
Oh, I am on
check you out.
I am on the interwebs. So I tweet pretty frequently at T.A. Noonan. It's all one word, so T.A. and Noonan. So no dots or underscores or anything like that. So I tweet pretty frequently there. I am on the Book of the Face. I have a personal page where I know a lot of people. I have a lot of I have a lot of friends on there, which is cool. That's easy enough to find. And then I have an author page as well, though I'm less good about updating that. I have a bad habit of forgetting that I'm supposed to do that kind of stuff, and so I don't. But I'm pretty good about being on Twitter. I also have a web page, sundresspublications.com/TA Noonan. TA Noonan's one word. That is, I'm behind on keeping up on that. I keep working on like completely revamping it, because I used to have this really great plugin that let me do my artwork on there. And I guess when they did the last update of it, it just broke. And I haven't been able to get it to work since. So, like, now everything's, like, all jacked up with my gallery. So I've been meaning to completely redo it. I just haven't had the chance to do it. So
awesome.
If people want to engage with me, I am on the social medias. I have a Tumblr, too. Though I'm slightly better with that than I am with my writer Facebook, and that's Place Oddity, placeoddity. So placeoddity.tumblr.com.
Awesome. So, folks at home can find you and everything. TA, it has been great having you on the program today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being a part of our birthday celebration, and for all the work you've done behind the scenes on this program.
Well, happy birthday.
Yay, woo. Anyway, so it has been great having you on the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's been awesome talking to you.
Awesome. And we'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
Woot!
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, This is your host, Scott C., signing off.